Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside. Repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Friend of a Friend podcast. I'm your host, Olivia Perez. If you've been in an airport in the past few years, chances are you've seen away suitcases in abundance. But just 4 years ago, Jen Rubio found herself stranded in an airport with a broken suitcase and not a single go-to brand to solve her problem. So in 2015, she and her co-founder, Steph Corey, decided to found Away, a luggage company that would change the way people travel today. The result was a collection of sleek luggages at an affordable price, complete with a portable charger and more travel essentials that emulate the modern traveler today. Away has sold over 1 million suitcases and counting worldwide and created a cult following of jet-setting customers who have made their product their most trusted travel companion. The company has raised over $156 million in support and recently announced their $1.4 billion valuation. In this episode, Jen and I talk about what it's really like to work in tech as a woman, how a coffee table book saved her business, and how she's determined to have it all at no expense. Here's my friend, Jen Rubio. So tell us a little bit about your upbringing. Where are you from?
My upbringing, I mean, I don't know how far back you want to go, but I was born in...
I want the origin story.
The origin of Jen Rubio.
Yes.
I'm like, it started with a suitcase. And people are like, no, the real origin. So I was born in the Philippines. And just a really lovely childhood there. I think growing up in a big, like, giant Filipino family, like 26 aunts and uncles on each side.
Wait, what?
Yeah, yeah. My mom and dad were each like one of, I don't know, 12 or 13. I don't even know.
But you just have a brother, right?
I have a brother and a sister.
Okay.
So it was me and my brother. We grew up in the Philippines. My sister was born here. And just all of my memories just have like dozens of people in them. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Like dinner every night was like open door, people in and out. And it was like a really good sense of community. And I actually remember when I moved to... New Jersey when I was like 6 or 7. I remember just being really lonely because I didn't have like all of these random cousins around all the time. And I think that's why I'm so like so outgoing now. And I also just like have, I mean, you know, I have tons of people at my house all the time, like even when I'm not there. And I feel like that's like me trying to get back to my roots. But yeah, I grew up in a giant family in the Philippines. We moved to New Jersey.
Why did you guys move?
I guess my parents just like wanted like a better life, you know. We had aunts and uncles here too, so we joined some of my family here. My mom, who is a dentist, like had to go back to school and do it all over again. So it was crazy seeing, like, you know, when you move from one country to another, like your degrees are like
totally different,
totally meaningless. Mm-hmm. Like you can't practice medicine. So it was really crazy seeing my mom go from like this incredible, like, medical provider with patients and like we knew all of them to having to go back to school as like
and
as
start
my mom
from square one.
Start from scratch, but she went and did that. There are a lot of, you know, we had a place in the city. There were a lot of times where you know, we would go meet my mom after like her NYU classes and stuff. So it was a really crazy thing to witness because I had always known my mom growing up as like a dentist, an oral surgeon. She was like super established and then like came here and started over. And it wasn't until I grew up that I realized how crazy that was.
Yeah. That must have been a really interesting thing to see as like a young girl.
Yeah. I mean, she and it felt totally normal to me because, like,
you don't know otherwise.
Yeah, you don't know that's weird. But, you know, other people's parents were, like, in their careers. And we're like, you know, my dad was so supportive. He passed away, 7 years ago. But during that whole time, he would just remember, like, he would pick us up from school. We would get in the car and, like, go see my mom in the city because she had, like, a late class, and we'd either all go home together or stay in the city. And that, to me, was totally normal. And if I think about how that, like, feeds into my relationships now, like, my fiancé is so supportive of me and, like,
also, fiancé, congrats.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thanks. And just, like, he just totally goes out of his way to do these things. And I have to remember, like, not to take that for granted.
Absolutely.
Like, it's really special that he does that. It was really special that my dad did that.
Right.
But I've always been surrounded with, like, that kind of support.
Did you feel like it was difficult as a young girl, as an immigrant in New York and New Jersey?
Yeah, I think there was definitely a sense of, I felt different, but I wasn't, you know, as a 7-year-old kid, I wasn't like, I'm an immigrant. This is right. Why I feel different. I was just like, oh, like, I eat different food at home, or, you know, like, what I bring to lunch is like, I remember begging my parents to get me, like, boring, like, Lunchables and things like that. And now I'm
love
just
Lunchables.
Like, why? Right. You know? But yeah, I remember that stuff being different, but it wasn't like, you know, I didn't really get, like, made fun of or anything like that. So I don't think it was like a blatant, like, I'm different and I'm being bullied type of thing. I was just like, something's off,
right?
Like, as a kid. And I think when you're young, you just really want to fit in. So I remember, like, doing things to try to be more like everyone else. You know, I remember I used to watch a ton of TV because, like, I spoke fluent English, but I didn't want to have an accent. So I used to, like, watch.
You had an accent, or you didn't want to have one?
I think I had a slight one, but I remember being very conscious of, like, my voice and how I sounded. So I would watch the news all the time as a kid and just, like, practice talking.
So what were you passionate about when you were young?
You know, nobody ever asks me that.
I think it's always interesting.
Yeah, it's amazing.
I mean, I always get asked that because I think that there's something that to be said about having some sort of an entrepreneurial spirit in tandem with kind of the way that you were in high school. I danced. I was always on stage. I was a performer. So that mm-hmm. aspect I feel like has carried into my job today.
Yeah, no, it's an amazing question because if I think about, you know, what I used to do all the time, I was, I like read all the time. I was like I always had a book. There's like pictures of me as a kid where I'm just like, in all different places, and I'm, like, off to the side reading a book. And I remember, you know, like, during meals, I'd be reading. Like, I just, like, read so much, and I actually miss reading as much as I used to. I would even read, like, you know, like, the back of, like, cereal boxes and things like that. I was just, like, obsessed with reading. And then I would I'd always be in, like, long car rides with my dad, and he would always ask me about what I was reading. So it was kind of, like, this, like, storytelling, and I would always, like, I remember one time he told me, like, I was reading a book and he asked me what it was about, and I totally made up a totally different story. But I guess, like, this, like, reading and storytelling has always been a passion of mine. And I think, I always just was – I've always, like, craved, like, being around people and, like, that, like, sort of sense of community that I had when I was, like, way younger. So I think I was looking for that all the time. But I wasn't, like, really that into sports. I wasn't really – I definitely wasn't passionate about sports. You know, I played them here and there. But it was more of, like, interacting with people in different ways. Like, you know how when you're younger, I don't know if you ever had those, like, kids' play sets and stuff, like the kitchen setups and stuff. So apparently I never used mine. And I would, like, play these games where I would have to – I, like, would set up a desk and have my own, like, little pretend office. So as a kid, I, like – I just never did homework. I never liked doing that stuff. But I would, like, sit at home at a fake little office desk. And I remember this – I mean, this didn't stop. I remember when – if we fast forward to, like, when I was in college, my first internship where I had a desk and my own phone and, like, my own badge, I was like, this is amazing.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I think part of it is my parents didn't have office jobs. So it was fascinating to me. Like, I grew up, like, in and around, like, medical offices. Like, you know, my entire family is, like, in, like, nurse, doctors, dentists, surgeons, like, in the medical field. So the whole concept of it was really foreign to me. Like, someone who went to work and had a computer and just sat there.
Yeah.
And it was really fascinating to me. Even when I was, like, an intern or co-op, like, as an adult, I was like, this is cool.
I remember, and just as, like, a little background for the audience listening, Jen was on a panel that I moderated at House in Toronto back in April. And you had said something on that panel about how infatuated you were with the idea of being a businesswoman.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I always found that really interesting because I think that is, as a young girl, I think that's not really something that you hear that often. And do you think that has to do with the fact that your family was doing something totally different? Or was there something that you saw as a child that inspired you to strive towards that?
Yeah, I think there's always that, like, when you're surrounded by one thing and you're inundated with it and you're kind of expected to do it. Like, my mom is so bummed that none of us, like, I'm doing what I'm doing now. My brother is an artist. My sister is, like, really into music. And she's like, wait, I, like, built this whole, like, dental practice empire. And there's, like, no one to take it over because, like, none of us were interested in it. But I think there's, like, that factor of you're surrounded by it. It's, like, all you know. And if you're a curious person, you're like, what else is out there?
Right.
And I think that's why I was so fascinated by it. I think if I had been born into a family full of, like, entrepreneurs and, like, business people, I would have gone into something else just because it was different, you know? So I think that's, like, where the fascination took hold. But yeah, I mean, it makes sense. And I always think that, you know, whenever I talk about, like, what my mom does or what the rest of my family does, it is very entrepreneurial. Like, they all run their own businesses. They all have to, like, get their own patients. It's just, like, a different kind of entrepreneurship, but I've always been around that kind of energy.
And you went to Penn State, right?
Yeah, for a hot minute.
What did you study while you were there?
I studied supply chain, which was like...
Is that a major?
Yeah. So it's a major. And back when I went to school, it was a major in like 3 or 4 schools, which was actually amazing because this was going into the recession. And basically everyone who had finance jobs no longer had finance jobs.
Right.
But because supply chain was like a super new major, all of the big CPG companies were recruiting from like Penn State, Arizona State, and the... like Northwestern. There's like a few schools that had it. So as a sophomore, I got like my first internship at Johnson & Johnson. And then I got a second one. And then I just like kept getting these internships. And then I took a semester off to do a co-op program, which is like you just take the semester off to work. And I was just like enamored by the whole thing. Like definitely not by what I was doing because I was doing like spreadsheets so that Walmart could get their baby powder, you know, like things like that. But I was just like, oh, like an office job. This is so foreign to me and I'm like really into it.
Was there something that you wish you studied in college that you think would help you as an entrepreneur today? Even in your brief time there?
Yeah. I mean, listen, I think it's so hard because I'm like, I'm fine
right
now.
Totally.
And so much of what like the reason I'm good at what I do is because I've like known where to look for the answers, you know, like
right.
I learned it as I go. I mean, I do wish though that I speak a lot at colleges and I do a lot of like guest teaching and stuff. And I think universities now have like this entrepreneurship track and I'm not sure what they're teaching there.
I'm actually very curious about that a lot.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
It's definitely a mentality, and I don't know if it's something that can be taught.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's what I'm getting at, where it's like I learned everything I know now through like resilience and like through just having like the right mindset and like being curious and knowing who to ask. And I think technical skills you can always pick up. Like I am not ashamed. Like I think last year I was like, you know what? I should really brush up on Excel so I can like – dig into financial models that like the team is sending me. You know what I mean?
Right.
And I'm not afraid to do that. And I think now we have so much more access to learning technical skills. So I'm not, you know, I think for a lot of people, the structure of college and the structure of having like a set list of classes that you take to get a major works, but it doesn't teach you, like, the grit and the mentality that you need to have your own company or to do your own thing.
Totally. I think that there's a missing link. I would hope that in those entrepreneurship classes, they're teaching finance, like how to do your taxes, how to form an LLC, mm-hmm. all of those things. Because I went to school for journalism. I did a little bit of fashion history, art history, and I left with a great degree. But when I went to start my company, there were so many things that I completely overlooked and messed up on and set me back because I just, no one ever told me.
Yeah. And if I think about, so my co-founder, Steph Corey, she went to business school. She was at Columbia. And so many of the classes that she took that I actually think are incredible were like, you know, leadership and management and how to coach a team and how to like hire the right people. And those are the things that you need to know.
Totally.
I mean, I think about so much of what our culture is because, you know, she had like a very strong point of view on the type of culture we wanted to build and why it's so important to manage people a certain way. And she taught me a lot of that. And I think that's super great and useful. But I think, you know, I took a marketing class in college. I have no idea what I learned or if any of that is relevant now.
Pro tip, when I was having a tough time figuring it all out, I used to read the Harvard Business Review. They have like 10 different books on specific things that business owners should know how to do. So on Amazing. Managing people, there was one on like just financial models. It really helped me. So that's a little pro tip. But where you went from Johnson & Johnson to, where were we after that, Neutrogena?
Yeah, so Neutrogena is owned by Johnson & Johnson.
Right.
So
you just moved within.
I just moved within. And at that point, so I had I was part of a co-op program, and then I like asked to stay. And that's where I ended up like not finishing. I just like never went back to school after that. And then like, yeah, it was just like super corporate. I was kind of into it, but also I didn't realize how corporations worked. You know, I was like,
right.
Oh, cool. This is interesting. I would be in these meetings with like marketing people, or like what they called marketing. And to me, they were always like the ones in the meetings who said the most interesting things. So then I started, I was like very bold and like set up, you know, asked to have lunch with all of these like very senior people in the marketing organization. And they're like very giving with their time and spent some time with me. And I asked a ton of questions, and I like got very interested in what they were doing. And I was like, oh, maybe that's my next move. Like, mind you, I don't know why I had any business doing that because I was, like, basically just an intern who had been there forever. I didn't have my degree. I actually looked back on a few emails I'd sent during that time, and I was, like, totally an idiot. So, but in my head, I was like, I'm going to go after this. And that's when I found out that you needed an MBA to, like, do what they do. And I was like, well, I can't get my MBA. So that's not happening. And this was around the time that I was, like, super interested in social media. It was like in the MySpace days, but like Tumblr had just started, Twitter had just launched, and I was super interested in it personally. And I just like saved up a bunch of money, and I was like, I'm gonna like pursue this thing that I'm curious about, which is like social media. Like, I was like, I feel like businesses can use this.
What attracted you to marketing?
I think it was like the connection with the people. So I was like the person on the other side of the spreadsheet, like doing like portfolio analysis for consumer products. And that was not that interesting to me, nor was I good at it. And I think it was like, oh, here's like a bunch of tools and technology and platforms where people can connect with other people. And I'd always been fascinated by that. Actually, this reminds me, like when I was a kid, I used to make websites all the time. I'm like,
whoa.
Yeah, on like GeoCities and Angel Fire. I'm like older than you, so I don't know if you remember this stuff.
I have no idea what those are.
Yeah,
but
they're like these like old like website platforms, and you know, oh God, I wish I still had them. Like, and you'd have like a website with like a little counter of like how many people came to the site at the bottom. And
I'm going to span back to when I asked what you were passionate about when you were younger and say that here's your full circle moment.
Here it is. Mm-hmm. And I just totally forgot about this.
Yeah.
But I was really interested in that. And there was like this, oh my God, you would like make these websites and you would join web rings. So I had one about like, I mean, I don't know, like let's say I made a website about shoes. I would join like a web ring for shoe websites, and you would like click through to all these different websites about shoes that other people made. Anyway, it was a wild time. I literally that memory just came back to me.
There you go.
I've never talked about that. Yeah. I mean, I think if there's like one overarching theme in my life, it's that I was curious about something, so I just went after it, and I've never really been scared to do that.
Do you think that curiosity is an important facet of being an entrepreneur?
Yeah. I mean, I think if you're not curious, then you just try to do things by the book, and the book doesn't tell you how to do anything, or there is no book. You know what I mean? I think you are, curiosity is something I look for now, even like as we hire people, because I'm just like, if you're not interested in knowing what the answer is, then you're not gonna find it. You're just gonna like, it's like if you took the top search result in Google for what it was like all the time, and that's like all you believed. And I think everything I've done, whether it's like I left a corporate job to literally like tweet for food trucks and like cafes that like shut down, and like that's like what I left Johnson & Johnson to do. I was like doing social media for businesses who were like, what is this, you know? Like that's what led me to that. And after that, I was like, you know, curious about like Facebook pages. And I ended up working at an agency that like literally made Facebook pages and Facebook apps for big brands. Like,
crazy.
Yeah, so anyway, it like my curiosity led me to all of these different things. And I think even now at Away, like we are always curious about like what to do next or how to do it differently. And I think I see a lot of companies who are like, sometimes I look at companies that launch and I'm like, they think they're following the Away playbook. And they're like, oh, Away did this, so we're going to do this. But they're not like thinking about why we did something or how, like really digging into how we did it. And that's the important part. Like, I think if I made a list of everything Away did over the last 3 years and like handed it to someone right now who is starting a company, it wouldn't be successful because like there's reasons for all of those things and why we did them at the right time. And we only figure that out like because we were curious.
I need you to touch a little bit on the food truck phase of your life.
Yeah.
Because I'm LA born and bred, and that was a huge thing in Los Angeles.
Yeah, I like lived in Culver City, like, you know, like drove through LAX every day. It was so weird. Anyway, these like, you know, obviously food trucks have always been like a big part of like LA culture. But do you remember when they would like start tweeting where they were?
The grilled cheese truck?
Yeah, the grilled cheese truck.
Followed that my whole high school.
Like Kogi Barbecue. Like mm-hmm. all, but so I was like part of that wave of people who were like, oh, there's this platform called Twitter, which launched in 2007. And you can like say where the truck is and people will show up. And that to me was incredible. Like the fact that I could go on this account, there were people following it. I would say the truck is, you know, on La Cienega and whatever. And then 30 minutes later, there's 100 people waiting in line to get food from the truck. I was like that to me is like marketing in its purest form.
Totally. And I think that's like the cornerstone of what we see today being the essence of community in terms of social media. It's, okay, there's this whole digital presence and you can have millions of followers and have such an engaged community. But the most exciting part about it is when that comes offline and you're in real life and
exactly.
getting to meet new people and actually have this like physical community.
Exactly. And that's what I loved. And I think, you know, a lot of times people talk about my time at Warby Parker where I did social media for them. The exciting parts of that are like when you can make that real life, you know, and to me, that's what's exciting about what we're doing at Away. Like we have stores, we do offline stuff. And it's like, yes, Away is very good at social media. It's very good digital marketing. You know, and the way people do it in this day and age, but like seeing that come to life like offline is really incredible. And that stems all the way back from those like taco truck days. And this was before like you had like the big food truck festivals and before like Abbott Kinney closed down
First Fridays.
Yeah, exactly.
I used to think that like going to First Fridays when I was in high school was the coolest
thing.
Was the
best. That for me was like the beginning. I was like, that showed me in a very big but also very small way how you could do something online and it translates to something real offline. And that led me to so many different things. So that was also the year of like Foursquare and like checking in, and there were like all these cool things you could do. And I remember just like thinking, like my ideas got bigger and bigger from like a food truck to, you know, how do you promote a movie using all these different platforms? And everything we're talking about now is like so obvious and so simple, but back then it wasn't.
And then to be at Warby Parker running social media, which was a huge shift for like retail and e-commerce.
Yeah, the Warby thing, I remember I was there and Instagram had just launched. And I was like trying, you know, I was telling Neil and Dave, I was like, there's this new platform called Instagram. We should join it. And they're like, okay, whatever. And I had no idea, like, you had no idea what it's going to be. Like, right. It could be like another platform that just died or whatever. But if I think about the stuff that we did on Instagram, I mean, or even Facebook at the time, you know, the whole like encouraging people to do their home try-on of like their five pairs and posting it on Facebook to let random strangers comment on which glasses they should get. Like we were doing that on Tumblr, we were doing that on Facebook. Like that whole concept of like user-generated content was like totally new. The whole concept of influencers was totally new. Now like there's careers built on this. At the time, I was like, I'm going to get 10 people from Tumblr and get them to come to this dinner. And like they're going to wear Warby Parker glasses. That was like a crazy thing.
Is there
which is so funny to think about.
This is kind of a weird question, but do you have a tip for navigating new waters like that? Because it sounds like you just had like this crazy tenacity and you were like, we're going to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is, like, having the conviction but also having the support of my bosses. You know, like, I couldn't have done it without them. And they're just like, okay, like, let's try it. I think nowadays there's so much around, like, what are the – like, it's so nice because I think, you know, when I was, like, navigating this, there weren't, like, the metrics and KPIs and, like, it was, like, all gut. It was like, we're going to do this.
Those were the days.
Yeah, those were the days. And now everyone's like, okay, what's the engagement rate? What's the return on this? And that's so important. But I think it's also really important for everyone to remember that you're not going to have that stuff for the really new things. Like things that have never been done before, you're not going to know how to measure. So you either have to like have faith and do it and then figure out if it worked or not. But by the time something is like super measurable, it's already done. Like someone's already done it. And then it's just like a marketing tactic. So I think having that balance of like, hey, this is something new. We can't really measure it, but like we have a really good gut instinct for it and let's try it and see. And then pairing that with like tried and true things that like where you can measure ROI, like that balance is really important.
I love that tip because I do think that there has been such a shift to the numbers when it comes to marketing these days. Mm-hmm. And while I do think that's crucial, obviously, to drive business, there is a sense of community that always needs to come, I think, from these initiatives that feel soulful and not mm-hmm. just about what's in your mind.
Yeah, and you know, like every day there are brands born that are like, you know, they launch a Shopify site, you can go buy Facebook ads, you can pour money into there. You see how many people are converting. But like those aren't brands. Those are just like websites who sell things. And I think to really be like real brands and real communities like have this commitment to doing things that aren't totally measurable. You know, obviously as you become a bigger business, like and as you scale, it is really important to have that balance. And I think that's even why at OA we have, you know, we have like the brand marketing team and like the growth marketing team. And, you know, the brand marketing team is actually super day driven and measures a lot of stuff, but they also know that a lot of the new things aren't totally measurable.
Speaking of brands with soul and talking about OA, I would love to hear the OA origin story.
I was at Zurich Airport. My suitcase broke. Embarrassing moment for sure, but, you know, it wasn't like my suitcase broke and I was like, oh, let's start a luggage company. I got home. I was living in London at the time. I was asking my friend and my friends like, you know, I'll go to Fashion Week. They travel all the time. They traveled for work. I was like, what suitcase do you use? Does anyone have a suitcase that they can recommend to me? And everyone's like, oh, I don't know what brand my suitcase is or yeah, I have one, but it was just like my mom gave it to me or I have one, but I hate it. Like, there's no recommendations. And again, this is like a world where everyone is obsessed with every brand, like everything they do. And and just, there's no brand that people are excited about in the luggage space. So I guess that got me thinking about, you know, how come, you know, like the Samsonites, the Tumis of the world, like all of these brands who've been around for so long, they've just totally become commodities. Like even people, you know, whether you spent $100 on an American Tourister bag or, I don't know, $700 on a Tumi bag, like it didn't matter to you. Because there's just like no brand love in that space. So that's what actually got me excited, where like not the thought of, you know, making luggage, which actually ended up being super exciting and now I'm obsessed with it. But the thought of like building a brand in a space where there was no loyalty. So that's how we started. I was thinking about it and then I called Steph, who had worked with me at Warby Parker. She's like my work wife. While we were there, and she'd gone off to business school, and I'd moved to London, and I'm telling her about it. And at that point, it wasn't like we're going to start this company. I was like, no, this company should exist. It's so crazy that there isn't one already. And she was the one who was like, we should do this. Like we're the ones who are the best equipped people in the world to do this, given our background, given how passionate we are about travel. And I moved to New York and slept on her couch, and we started the company.
I love that. I love particularly about that story that you guys set out to fill a void. I think that's so important in businesses today because I do think The market is so oversaturated. And I think I also have an extreme amount of respect for everybody in the industry today because to start a brand is really difficult. But I think a lot of brands are started just to have one and not to fill.
Can we talk about that?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I know you see this all the time. Where someone's like, I just want to be a founder,
right?
And you're like, of what?
Of what? It's founder fatigue, I think.
Yeah, because it's also like very, you know, culturally, like it's very glamorous to be a founder, an entrepreneur, to like do your own thing, and no one ever talks about what that actually means. But yeah, I think, I mean, don't get me wrong, it is much harder now to find a void. But
absolutely.
People are like, how did it happen so fast? Like, how did you get so much momentum? And it's because we were fulfilling a real need versus just like creating another product or creating another line and trying to get it out there. And I think that's what we think about all the time with new products. We're going into apparel. We're going to wellness. Obviously, clothes and skincare and wellness are like super saturated markets. So I'm always challenging the team to think about like what, like I don't want a way to just be like putting random things into this world. Like what need are we filling? Like what do people really want that they don't have yet? And how are we the experts in that? And how do we tell that story? Because otherwise you're just like, you know, the world doesn't need like another random face mist. When I talk about a way going to apparel and wellness, like if we're just making stuff that doesn't really fill a need or tie back to our mission of better travel, then there's no point in doing it.
And I think it's interesting because travel is so specific. I mean, to me, and yes, I'm so biased. I'm the biggest Away fan ever. I have like a whole room of suitcases, especially at my family's house. But like the thoughtfulness that went into the design and the extras within the suitcase is like unparalleled. Like no other suitcase company comes with that. Can you speak to the design and thought process behind that?
Yeah, and I'm glad that comes through because like the conversations that we have like at Away are really centered around this. So I think part of it stems from the fact that I think one of the reasons Warby Parker is so successful is because, you know, of like the customer feedback and they're constantly iterating. And we just took that to like really took it to heart. It's like being customer obsessed is our number one thing. We like listen to our customers. We incorporate all of their feedback into our products. But even when we were first making the first suitcase, you know, Steph and I have no experience in luggage. So it was like that curiosity that drove us to be like, why is, you know, this luggage is supposed to be supposedly the best. Why? Like this luggage is not marketed as anything. And we really dug into that. And we realized that as we were designing our own luggage, that the only way this would be like really special is if we actually asked people what they needed. So I think what that results in is like it's never really a list of like marketable features. Like there's one feature that some people like are crazy about, and it's the laundry bag. So in the suitcase. There's a laundry bag that rolls up into this like little pocket and it zips shut and it's like, and you can remove it. And
instead of stealing them from every hotel you're in.
Exactly, which is what people would say that. But we didn't come up with that because we were like, because we went on ebags.com and saw that all the suitcases had a laundry bag and they didn't. We came up with that because we talked to like dozens and dozens of people. We ended up talking to over 800 people as we were designing the bag. And one of the things that kept coming up was that people would steal laundry bags from hotel rooms, or people have like would like shove their clothes into plastic bags and not know anything. So it was such a small little insight that led to literally this thing that people are obsessed about, that when they discover, you know, we don't market it. We're not going to put out a billboard that's like, there's a laundry bag in this suitcase.
Right, but it's an added perk.
It's an added perk, and it's something that like speaks to how thoughtfully designed it was. And we put that level of thought into like literally every aspect of the bag. I mean, there's things like, there was one holiday season where we came out with dop kits where it's like, how can you reinvent a dop kit? Like, we're not sitting here saying we're reinventing anything, but we're just looking at it to make sure there's super thoughtful little details. So in that dop kit, there was like a place to put your toothbrush like separately so that you don't need like a toothbrush cover, or like it's not just like floating around in there,
right,
with all your stuff. Like, we have a bag called the Everywhere bag that sits perfectly on top of your suitcase because, as you know,
it slides in.
It slides on the handle.
Like, it's the best thing.
Every woman who's ever traveled knows like the pain of like your purse falling off when you're wheeling the suitcase and you're like, ugh.
It's actually the best thing of all time.
Just, I mean, I'm obsessed with it. But I don't, and some people don't even know this, there's a hidden pocket at the bottom where you can put shoes.
Oh, yeah,
or
the bottom
wet stuff. Yeah.
You lift up.
Or an umbrella.
Let me tell you the best way to travel. I'll tell you right now. It's with that bag and then the carry-on suitcase that has the laptop zipper in the front.
Oh, you love the pocket. Oh. You love the pocket.
I die for the pocket. Yeah. Actually, the most recent suitcase I got had adapters for every country in it.
Yeah.
It's amazing to see the way you guys are evolving, but I can also tell that it's distinctly based on your consumer needs and what they want.
Yeah, and also if you just think about things like, of course, it, you know, people are like, when is Away coming out with a tote bag? And we've been working on it. But the reason it's taken so long is because we're like, all right, we're not just going to put another tote bag into the world, right? Like, what do people need? We're actually making the tote bag because our customers have asked for one. They want one that isn't going to fall off the top of their suitcase, but they also want one that, like, when they get to their destination and they're on a work trip, that they can take it to the meeting and it doesn't look like a travel bag.
Right.
So, like, how do you incorporate all of that into, like, a beautiful design to something people want to use every day? And I think it's the same thing with, like, a backpack. We have a backpack now, but we're working on more iterations based on that. And I think people are like, oh, I don't know how to design for a customer. It's like, you're just not listening.
Right.
You know, all we do is listen. We like read all the comments, all of those. We have like processes internally where all of those comments are funneled to the right teams to make sure we're actually listening. And that to me is like the best and most important part of being direct to consumer, because we can actually listen to people versus like you make a product, you sell it in a bunch of department stores, and maybe you have like global distribution really quickly, but you don't know what people actually think about your product. And if it's not selling, you don't know why. Like, if we make something that doesn't sell, we know exactly why. Like, we know that, oh, they didn't like, you know, we're not guessing like, oh, maybe they didn't like that color. We know that it was too light or it was too dark, or actually had nothing to do with the color and they didn't like where the zipper was. And we take that into account for like the next thing that we make.
I really love all of the creative partnerships that you guys do. I loved the Minions one.
Minions.
I loved the Poppin'
Suki one.
You're
the Minions number one fan.
I really am. I talk about it all the time. and you just had one come out that was all in rainbow for Flower Shop.
With Flower Shop. That was such a delightful partnership.
I'm curious, in tandem to what you were just saying in terms of taking data from your consumers and seeing what it is they like and pivoting towards there, what goes into the process of those creative and strategic partnerships?
Well, I think the partnerships is like an inherent sense of who our customer is and what customer segment we're trying to speak to and what they like. And obviously, there's a lot of overlap in like Away's like core, like stylish younger consumer and like Flower Shop, like and the brand Amira's built, and the kind of, it's always interesting, like, you know, 10 years ago, if I told you like a luggage company and a bakery like would do a collab, and it would be this thing that the internet went wild for and sold out in 13 minutes or
what?
Something. Yeah. Like, you'd be like, that's crazy. I mean, even today it's crazy.
I didn't know that.
But
that's crazy.
Yeah, our customers have always been asking for brighter colors. We have some, but, like, you know, they're more muted. Our palette's more muted, but we're like, let's try this out. And actually, I met Amira on a plane. We were on a plane to San Francisco, and we, like, had imagined doing, like, I don't even know what we're talking about. We're just like, imagine like a photo shoot where there's like suitcases with like sprinkles coming out of them. And a year later, we have this collab. And she had this idea to do the – so Flower Shop cakes are like every color of the
rainbow.
They're
also the greatest cakes in the whole world.
Yeah, they're absolutely delicious.
Delicious.
But also so beautiful.
Yeah.
And they, you know, it's like a stacked like layered rainbow cake with sprinkles inside. And she was like, I want suitcases in every color of the rainbow. So we made them, and it, like, not only was, like, a great brand fit and, like, a great creative fit, but, like, fulfilled the customer desire of having super bright colors. And this is where, you know, as much as we listen, we also get it wrong because we were like, oh, we're going to have these. We'll have them in stock for a month. And they sold out on the first day. And now people are, like, very upset. So we're handling that. And that's a good problem to have.
Totally.
But yeah, but I think also, like, even from this, we're learning. We're like, okay, which one sold out the most? Never would have guessed orange was the most popular. So, wow. And we've actually, if I look back in our history of collabs, we've only made, like, one other orange suitcase, and it was the NBA one. You know, so there's a lot of things we're learning even from this. We're like, okay, we're going to incorporate orange more into, like, our next colorway. And that's not something you're going to get from, like, watching shows and looking at, like, what's trendy and... You know, we're just like people are making our jobs very easy for us. They're like literally just telling us what we want and we just have to make it. And it's exciting because somebody said to me, like, well, doesn't that mean like you're not really building a brand? You're just like crowdsourcing things. But it's like it's an art form to do it in a very tasteful way and to still do it in an aspirational way.
I'm so curious about your growth because I think that luggages, most people just have one set for their whole life. But mm-hmm. hearing what you just said about Flower Shop, that it's sold out instantly in different colors, it's like your suitcases at this point have become collector's items. And it's an amazing business because what used to be a business where it was like you have one customer and you've attracted that one customer like only one time in their lifespan, now you have people that are return customers buying suitcases and housing them and keeping them for their life. So
yeah.
That's so interesting to me in terms of your growth, if you can speak to it a little bit.
Yeah. Well, that to me is like, the best part of all this is that we've changed consumer behavior, right?
Yes.
So even like, by the way, our suitcases have lifetime warranties. You're not meant to buy more than one set, you know?
I have six in my apartment.
Yeah,
right now.
But like, you're not, like, for us, you know, that it was so crazy when we were first starting the company, we were talking to investors. They were like, to them, the lifetime warranty and the fact that the suitcases last forever was like a big problem. They're like, you can't build a business out of this. People just build one. You know, there are companies that exist out there that, like, make things that are designed to break so that you buy more. And we're like, we're not doing that, but we're going to build this brand in a way that makes people come back. If it's not for more suitcases, it's going to be for other things. Like, the vision was always for a bigger travel brand where we make more products. But even if you just think about wheeled suitcases, just luggage, we created a brand that people are so excited to buy from that – now there's like this whole behavior around, like, you know, we have customers who have like their work suitcase and their like vacation suitcase. I have that. You know, like my vacation one has like lots of fun stickers on it. And then like when I go on work trips, I just have like my monogram black one.
Chic.
Yeah. But it's just, but that's the thing. And or people like see like the Flower Shop collab and they're like, oh, I need to add to my collection. And I think doing that, like that was a very away thing, and like I'm super proud of that, and that's just like really because we're creating things that people really want. You know, we're not getting people to come back because like their stuff's breaking or it's not good, or like we're not tricking anyone into anything. But we did, you know, from the beginning, we're always conscious that if we couldn't do that we still had a scalable business. So the business was built around, you know, if someone only ever buys one suitcase, can we still make this work? And that's how we built the business. And then we realized over time that it was going to be much bigger than that.
I've asked you this question before, but not on the podcast. But Away really is a company for everybody. And it's not for a specific demographic. It's not super expensive. It's not, you know, something that like breaks in 5 seconds. But what goes into, or what went into, the thought process of designing a company that's meant for everybody?
You know, it's so funny because I am really proud of that fact, but I think it's like hard to talk about as a brand person, because if you go into it trying to make something for everybody, then nobody will love it. You know what I mean? Where it's just like, it just becomes like a very mass market thing. And I was super aware of that from the beginning. We didn't go into it saying we're going to build a brand for everybody. We went into it saying, let's build a brand that like just directly addresses what our future customers will need. And I think that is what's drawn everybody in. So we never went in saying like, oh, we're going to build like a millennial brand or this or that. Like it wasn't specific to a demographic, but it was specific to a set of needs that travelers had. And basically because we addressed those needs directly, everyone has those needs when they travel. So that's what pulled everybody in. But that's a very different approach from saying, let's make something for everyone, because then what you end up with is like some super bland, like mass market thing that's like not exciting for anyone. I'm like really proud of the fact that we've built a brand that spans generations, that spans like, you know, we have customers who think that our price point is really affordable and know that they're getting like a really amazing suitcase for like a super affordable price. And then we have customers who like maybe spend all year like saving up for a suitcase, and this is a big purchase for them. But both of those customer groups value the brand and the suitcase the same way, which like we're really proud of. So I think it's important to build something that means something. And I'm excited by the fact that Away means something a little different to everyone, because it's like, and it's just like travel, you know what I mean? Like when you travel and you go to a place, it could mean like Paris could mean something totally different to you than it does to me. But like the fact that we have this emotional connection to it is what's important. And that's the way we've always thought about building our brand.
There's one particular story of your brand story that I absolutely love, because I think it speaks to you as an entrepreneur and a creative problem solver, and it's your launch story with the coffee table book.
Yeah. So we had we had a self-imposed deadline to launch before Christmas of 2015. Great time to launch a product, like the gift-giving
right.
time.
People are spending.
Gift guides, yeah. People are spending.
It's the best time.
Yeah, PR is like thirsty for, like editors like thirsty for new products. So highly recommend doing it if you can. But around September, actually this was like the week before Burning Man. What was I thinking going to Burning Man? Like when you're launching a company.
I was going to say, I cannot believe that you.
I don't know. I can't believe
Steph
let me go. She's the week before Burning
Steph.
Man.
Good friend.
And I haven't gone since, so that says a lot. So the week before Burning Man, August 2015, we realized that there was no way in hell we were going to have the suitcases like ready to ship out. But we had like this big launch like plan and this like strategy that we were excited about. And we were working out of a WeWork at the time, and Steffler sits me down. She was like, what are we going to do? And I'm like, well, we'll just launch later. And she was like, no, that's not an option. By the way, it was totally an option. But I think part of why Away has grown so quickly is that Steph and I always push each other to like do kind of like unnecessary extreme things. She was like, that's not an option. We have to launch. And I was like, oh God, okay, it's not an option. What are we going to do? And we like literally sat in this tiny room in a WeWork space in like the financial district. And we're like, okay, we can line up all this press. We can do this. Like, what are we going to do to get people to talk about the brand? Like, we should still sell stuff. There's a great time to sell stuff. But it has to be really true to the brand that we're building. And I was like, I know, we'll write a book. She was like, what? And I was like, yeah. We'll get my friend Alexis, who's like a writer. She'll like, we'll get a freelance for us and she can write this book. And we were literally just like brainstorming. And by the other day, we'd come up with this idea to interview 40 people in our network that were like tastemakers. So God, the book would be so different if we did it today. But like people who were like respected in their communities and had good taste, like I remember the Sweet Green founders were in the book. and just people who like could talk about it. So and they would tell us their travel stories, and we realized later that like we needed photos and didn't have the rights or the money for any like travel photos. So we asked people to contribute their photos as well. And we would design like this beautiful book in this like really beautiful like collector's box. And inside there would be a gift card for $225, which is how much the first suitcase was going to be. And the reason we did this was like, this was a time when a lot of brands were coming out with you know, products on Kickstarter or pre-orders. And that to me was like super depressing. Like I've pre-ordered so many things that just like never shipped. The whole concept of a pre-order to me was like really lame. And we didn't want to launch a Kickstarter product because, again, we weren't launching like a new invention. We were just launching like a really thoughtfully designed suitcase. And imagine a Kickstarter for like
that,
a thoughtfully designed suitcase with a laundry bag. Like, no. So none of those things worked for us, which is why we didn't go down that route. But what we wanted to build was a brand. And I actually think this book was the best thing that ever happened to us. So we did it. I like went to Burning Man. I like set up all these interviews.
You're like, buy stuff. Yeah. I'm going off the map for like
No, but I
ever.
Like I found I convinced my friend to do it. We're like I set up all these interviews right before I left. And I remember like as we were driving, like in the RV, I was like, okay, we're about to lose service. I'm like connecting her with like the last few interviews for the book. And then I came back and she had done all of them. And I was like, okay, I'm sorry. I'm never leaving again. That was really stupid.
But this whole I love this story so much because it's such a testament to being malleable as an entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. And I think that so many like young professionals set themselves up against sometimes like unattainable expectations, but then also like have this like tunnel vision that doesn't also allow them to like shift with the world around them that, and you need to constantly evolve.
Yeah. I think that's like a super important thing that you just said. The fact that like we needed to set these expectations for ourselves that like weren't really that necessary. Like no one told us we had to launch. I mean, we had investors at the time, but like no one was like, you have to launch before Christmas.
Right.
Launches get delayed all the time, but we like had set it up for ourselves that like we were going to launch at this time. But the important part isn't that we said we're going to launch by Christmas by selling this, by doing this exact thing. And I think you can set like crazy expectations for yourself if you give yourself the flexibility to do it in a different way and to be malleable and to like come up with new ideas or vice versa, where if you like tell yourself you have to do something exactly a specific way, then you have to give yourself the flexibility to do that on a different timeline. But if you're saying, I have to do this thing by this time and that's the only way it's going to happen, then you're just like setting yourself up for failure.
Speaking of investors, I would love to hear a little bit about how you and Steph went into the investor stage of your business.
Yeah, it's if we actually think about the early stages of investment, we were trying to get people – like our very first investment deck was all about this travel brand that we wanted to build. And I think looking back now, people were like, oh, yeah, great. Yeah, I would have invested in that. But no one was interested in that. You know, we talked about building a brand like Sweetgreen or SoulCycle, like brands with communities, and that we wanted to build a travel brand in the space that would open up a lot of doors to sell different things from luggage to apparel to all the things we're doing now, basically. But that was not like a sellable idea. No one was like
community. I'll buy into that. Right?
Like, yes. Everyone's like. So we actually changed our pitch, and we were like, we're gonna start the Warby Parker for luggage, and we used to work at Warby Parker, and people are like, oh, I get it, which is crazy because it distills what we're doing into such a small thing. But what we learned about investors is that they love pattern recognition. So you tell them that's why like every pitch is like, it's Uber for this or Airbnb for that.
A reference point.
Yeah, they just need that reference point of something that's been exciting. It means that you're like dumbing down your idea to whatever. Like I didn't feel amazing about the pitch, but people got it. You know what I mean? Like, and I think that's so important to realize when you're going out for investment that you might have a big vision, but investors, and I'm saying this from the other side too because I've started investing a lot, where like investors don't know what's going on in your head. So they're looking for a reference point. They're looking for something that's been successful in the past, And then once you can click with them on that, then you can dive into the things of like, what's the pain point you're trying to solve? Like, why are you the best person in the world to solve this? And like, and how are you going to do it? And luckily for us, that worked whether we were pitching it as like this broad travel brand or just as like a direct-to-consumer luggage company. Like either way, there were pain points to solve. We were equipped to do it, and like we had a plan. And it ultimately boils down to that. But I think I hate to say it, but sometimes like you come in with a really big vision and people don't get it, and you just have to like water it down a little bit.
Did you ever feel like you were at a disadvantage being a woman and being two female founders?
No, and I think it's so funny because, one, our very first like institutional investor is a woman, Yuri Kim from Forerunner Ventures, co-led our seed round. I think that because we had like, you know, Steph and I did a ton of work like behind the scenes just like practicing our pitch. Like we had so much conviction in what we were doing and how we were doing it. And, you know, we'd read like every blog post on the planet, like, you know, First Round Capital, does these like amazing posts for like first time entrepreneurs. And we'd like read all of them, like really digested all this stuff. And we, you know, something we never lacked was confidence. And I say this all the time, like, is it possible that we were discriminated against because we were two women? Probably. Did we notice it? No. And I think it's just like when you have that level of like, one, we were naive. Two, we were just super confident. So we probably didn't notice like all of the like microaggressions that happen towards women. I think that's the hardest too, because it's like, if you walk into a room and someone does something inappropriate or like harasses you and it's obvious, you're just like, and I think that's a lot of the stories that we hear, like, you know, during the Me Too movement, like when it's obvious, it's easy to walk away from that. You don't know if the male investor that you're talking to is like, you know, checking his phone or like not really listening, like because you're a woman or because like you're just bad at presenting.
Right.
You know? So I think it's like those little like microaggressions that are the toughest to solve for. And we definitely encountered those. And we definitely encountered people who didn't invest and didn't like our pitch or like weren't into us. And that's fine. But we never like walked out of a room feeling like it's because we're women.
It's amazing to hear that you are now passing the torch and investing yourself. What are you most interested in investing in right now?
I don't think I'm ever going to be one of those people that invest in things like I don't know about, because then I can't be helpful.
Right.
You know, so I get like, I'll get pitched for like a fintech startup and I'm like, sorry, I
have no idea what you're talking about.
Sounds amazing, but I have no idea. So yeah, new consumer brands. And I think to me, it's so interesting. And a big reason why I invest is because I learn so much from these pitches. So there's a new underwear company that I can't mention it yet, but that I just invested in it. But I remember they're telling me about like how they're going to bring it to market. And I asked them questions like, oh, how many people do you have on your email list now? And they like looked at me like I was crazy. They're like, what? No, we have like a text list. Or like,
what?
We're going to reach our customers this way. And it was like this whole like Gen Z way of thinking that I was like, oh my God, I'm like an old, like I don't know how to reach this group of customers anymore, which is so funny, but I just like learned so much through them. And to me, it's like really exciting that there's this new generation launching these brands. But I think, you know, same, it's like consumer brands that are solving problems, consumer brands that have like a real point of view on why they should exist and a white space that they're filling.
That's really exciting. What do you think that entrepreneurs should be more transparent about with each other?
Like how hard it is. I feel like there's so much, especially on social media, of like how glamorous and how fun it is and like all the cool things that you get to do. And no one ever talks about how hard it is and like how, you know, how often you get rejected and like how that does like a lot to your psyche and like to your confidence. And I always want to encourage like openness and vulnerability.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And I think that's the number one thing, like not just what entrepreneurs should talk about with each other, but everyone. Like the more vulnerable you are, the more you have the space to grow and get mm-hmm. help. Like actually the more I admit what I don't know or what scares me, that's actually when I find that, like, people are most willing to help or teach me. And that's when I grow as a person. So I think that's so important. Like, if you go into anything being like, I have to know everything, I can't be scared. And, like, I don't want that to be what anyone takes away from anything I say, because, like, if you're just confident and not scared all the time, then, like, you're not giving yourself the room to grow.
There was something that I posted yesterday. It was a comment that Cleo Wade said back to somebody who commented on her photo announcing her pregnancy.
Mm-hmm. I saw that.
Yes.
I saw that.
And essentially what it was is someone commented on her Instagram saying, I don't know why all of these women, once they hit the top, decide to get pregnant, and it basically ruins their careers. And Cleo obviously clapped back immediately. And I love to touch on this subject because I do think that as a young entrepreneur myself, I have been told so many different iterations of what it means to have it all. I've been told that I can have it all, but not all at once. I've been told that I can only have the career. I've been told that I can just have a family and a quiet life, but you are, like, literally a shining beacon of having it all. Jen just got engaged. Hi, Stuart. You're probably not going to listen, but
he listens to all my podcasts.
I had a feeling you would. I do want to talk about what that means to you, having it all, especially in this really exciting moment of your life, one of just getting a $1.4 billion valuation and also being engaged and about to get married.
You know, I agree with everything you said, and I disagree with everything you said, because, like, I think all of it rings true at some point. And I think what it comes down to is what's important to you. Something that Cleo said in her response that really resonated with me was that I'm not having a moment, I'm having a life. And yeah, I think from the outside, definitely looks like I have it all. Like, just got engaged with this, like, amazing company. I just got a puppy.
Cutest puppy ever, by the way.
Like, I cannot wait to see her today. But all of those things, like, if you dig into it, it's like, yes, I'm engaged to someone who lives on the other side of the country. And we, like, have to sacrifice a lot to even, like, see each other. And we have to, like, plan ahead. And it's, like, not a traditional relationship. Or I've built this company, but the expense of, like, some friendships, because I haven't been able to be, like, super present as a friend in the past. So I think what I think every person needs to understand is that as a human who's, like, evolving, your set of, like, what's important to you is going to be different at any point in time, and that you have to decide what's important to you and, like, give yourself to those things. And what's important to me today might not be the same things that are important to me next year or 3 years from now. Certainly different from what's important to me 5 years ago. But you have to give yourself that freedom. I don't think it's like, you can't decide, like, oh, like, building a family is important for me, so that's the only thing I'm going to think about for the rest of my life. Because then you're not, like, you're crazy if you don't think your priorities are going to change, you know?
Totally.
And for some people, that may never be a priority. And that's fine. But, like, I think happiness and, like, success comes from knowing, like, what's actually important to you. And that's not going to be the same for two people.
So with the new valuation, what does that mean for the future of Away?
It honestly means that we get to build out our vision in a really big way. And we've always had this big vision. But it means that we are equipped with the capital to do it better, and in some ways faster, and to do it more thoughtfully. You know, obviously, because we're not thinking about, like, capital needs, we can build the business in a very thoughtful way, but also in a really big way. I think a lot of the things that, you know, people are just like, oh, well, it's money, so that means they're just going to, like, spend it and grow bigger. But we want to do it, like, in a way that will last for a really long time. And that means, like, bringing on, like, incredible new leadership to help us build this, you know, rethinking the way we're opening all of our stores and creating all of our new products. So it feels like, very much feels like the next phase of the company, you know, going from, like, a scrappy startup to, like, a real long-lasting brand.
What's your biggest tip for somebody who wants to build a brand today?
Make sure you have a reason for doing it. Like, don't do it just because you're like, I'm going to build a brand. Like, make sure there's a need that you're fulfilling, like we talked about, and that you have a real point of view on it.
What is it that you feel most insecure about looking forward at your career, having achieved success at a young age?
I think a lot, so it might be weird to say 32, but I think a lot about my legacy and like, what it is that, like, people remember me for. And I think that because I'm so open to the idea of change and doing something new, like I'm like in this for the long haul, and I like want to build a brand that like really resonates and like lasts like far beyond me. But I also don't know like what exactly my place is in that as the company evolves or as I evolve as a person. And I think I'm like surrounded by people who are doing it in all different ways, which is exciting. But I have no idea what the rest of my career looks like. But I'm also just like really excited by that because it's not like it wasn't like we set out to do this and build a company and have it be worth $1 billion and like, okay, cool, that's it, done. You know, like I look at Away and I'm like, there's so much more that we need to do. So I'm just focused on that right now. But yeah, it's kind of crazy that you say that because it's like some days I'm just like, God, it's been like 5 years. Like we've been doing this for so long. And other days I'm like, I can't believe it's only been 5 years and we have so much more to do. But yeah, I try not to worry about it too much. And I think if I had tried to predict what I was going to be doing when I was like in my early 20s, I would have been totally wrong. So I'm definitely not going to try to predict the future now.
For more, subscribe to the Friend of a Friend podcast on the Apple Podcast page and our newsletter on friendofafriend.com.